Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. This week we are talking Blue Note Records and audiophile vinyl with tone poet Joe Harley. Now, as many of you know, Joe has an enormous legacy in the vinyl record community, reissuing some of the most beloved jazz albums ever recorded in the audiophile format for the Music Matters Jazz record label. However, now Joe is weaving his vinyl alchemy directly for Blue Note Records with the Tone Poet series. Joe is the tone poet. He uses his ear and love for the vinyl format to create a signature series of releases direct from the original Blue Note tapes. Now today, Joe shares all about the process of creating audiophile reissues from the Blue Note library, his history with the Blue Note label, what it's like to be in the Blue Note archive and hold and listen to those original tapes recorded so long ago by Rudy Van Gelder and the Blue Note team. And if you like hearing about jazz or the process of audiophile vinyl production, we have several other episodes in the Vinyl Guide archive you may enjoy, including episode number 105 with Blue Note president Don Was. Don and I discussed the Blue Note legacy, their approach to vinyl, the Blue Note review box set. It's a fascinating discussion. Episode number 105 of the Vinyl Guide. We've also had a man on the other side of the Blue Note microphones, Dr. Larry Ridley, bass player for sessions and albums of the likes of John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Thelonious Monk, Lee Morgan. Dr. Ridley's episode is number 70 of the Vinyl Guide. And of course, we've also had mastering legend Bernie Grundman on the show discussing the art of mastering audio for vinyl. That's episode number 86 of the Vinyl Guide. All these episodes and heaps more are available to download, listen, and enjoy anytime from the Vinyl Guide mobile apps or directly from thevinylguide.com. And hey, if you like our show and appreciate what we're doing here on The Vinyl Guide, please consider becoming a show patron at patreon.com/vinylguide. Now, clearly, this show is a labor of love. Believe me, nobody is getting rich off journalism of vinyl records. So whatever patronage you could share will help keep us going, help us keep churning out more episodes. There's even exclusive content, pictures, video, extra episodes, all sorts of things for the Vinyl Guide patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. So please head on up there, support us how you can, and please know that we truly appreciate the patronage. So there we go. The upfronts are done. Let's kick into our discussion on audiophile jazz, vinyl records, and the spaces in between the notes with tone poet Joe Harley. This week on The Vinyl Guide, I'm very excited. We have on the show Joe Harley, the tone poet. We're going to talk Blue Note Records. We're going to talk vinyl pressings, audiophile records, heaps more. Joe, as you know, is a founder of Music Matters and a man with tremendously good ears and taste. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you, Nate. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are our people here. I've heard many tales of your record collection, very vast. Vinyl is your format of choice, clearly, yeah?
Absolutely.
I read an interview with you at one point. The thing that really turned you on, the record that really turned you on to Blue Note, was Sonny Clark, Cool Struttin'.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And yes.
Do you still have that record?
Of course.
Ah, good. That's a good
record.
Great one to find. Oh. Oh, all right. You're making me jealous now, Joe. So I'm a huge fan of Blue Note, and the work you've done and the access you've had to materials is astounding. And I really want to know everything. But let's first start with the question. With the advent of digital, with surround sound options, with home theater now pretty much ubiquitous, why do you feel vinyl is still the format of choice for listening to music?
With vinyl, you're actually amplifying the waveform. The literal waveform is etched onto the record, and you're simply amplifying that rather than using algorithms to go through a bunch of, converting ones and zeros into an analog form. It's a vastly more direct approach to hearing what was recorded. It isn't easy to get it done correctly, but at its best, it's shockingly close to the original source.
So to me, that's interesting because you're one of the few people who have actually heard the original Blue Note masters direct off the tape. And so
hundreds actually at this point.
Yeah, and when you compare what's on the tape to what's on the records, how much would you say gets onto the final records? Is it 80%, 90%?
You know, I would say more like 95%. With vinyl, it's not a perfect medium. And of course, it depends on each person's playback rig. But vinyl is, at its best, is capable of getting really close, really close. Now, the vinyl's going to be a little bit rounder sounding in some aspects. And it also, this is kind of controversial, but I've gone down this road before, so I don't care. I'll go ahead and say it. Vinyl also introduces, if we're going to be really accurate about it, it's a distortion, but I don't mean the kind of distortion that we don't like. I'm talking about phase distortion and channel bleed, that sort of thing, that has the effect of making the vinyl, by comparison to if we had a Studer tape deck and we played the master and then we played the vinyl would actually would present a little bit larger at its best and a little bit rounder in certain ways. And it is a distortion, but it's incredibly pleasing. I like it. I know what it is, and I still prefer it. So I don't, you know, that's not what most people want to hear. But in my opinion, having sat there with masters and then played vinyl, it's, I think it's an accurate statement. But for pure pleasure, I like the vinyl.
With your experience with Music Matters, now you started the Music Matters Jazz label around 2007, 2008?
2007 with Ron Rombach. It's two of us. So Ron Rombach, it's really his company, and I helped him start that part of it. He'd had that company for quite a while selling Rare Records. But the Blue Note part, I helped him get that going, and then went to all the mastering and helped and continue to help with many aspects of that operation.
So you guys partner together. You have this vision for getting some of the great jazz albums of all time onto high quality vinyl. You approach Blue Note. Don wasn't in the picture at this point, I imagine. No?
It was not. And Blue Note at that time was owned by EMI. So we approached Michael Cascuna, who is a hero to anyone who loves Blue Note and is certainly a hero to me. I'd known him for many years, had actually advised him in a few aspects of his Mosaic reissues. I can remember when you know, they were proudly pointing out that the LPs were mastered from digital, and he called up and he goes, "People don't like that." I said, "No, they don't." And I can tell you why. They want it to be analog. So we had known each other for many years, and he was incredibly helpful in helping us navigate through the EMI chain at that point, to get this to happen.
And you strike the deal, starting off with probably a few of the titles. Do you remember which ones you started off with?
Yeah, I do. We started out with an Art Blakey and the Messengers record called The Big Beat. And the other, we would do these in pairs. And the other one was Horace Parlan Speaking My Piece. Great record.
They get you the tape, I imagine, the master tape.
Yes.
Do they fly it out? Like, what does it look like? They can't FedEx these tapes. They wouldn't do that, would they?
No, they don't, actually. I hear all kinds of rumors and, you know, oh, they shipped the tape to the UK. No, they didn't. They might have shipped a copy, but they didn't ship the master. And they don't ship them across the country either. The tapes are all in L.A. at a facility. They're all there. So it simply involves a messenger. And I was mastering literally last Wednesday, and a Lee Morgan record, Cornbread, great record.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, messenger comes with the master tapes, and that's how it works.
They stay within LA. Okay.
Yep.
And all the Blue Note tapes are in one facility?
Yes.
Is it the same with the artwork as well? Are they in one facility, or how do you get access to the artwork, the pictures, the tapes, that sort of thing?
So when we, so Michael has, Kuskuna has the entire Francis Wolfe archives. And with Blue Note, what we prefer to do is to get the original photo that was used for the cover. And so we will literally rebuild the cover using the original photo rather than just do a scan of the jacket, which is how most reissues are made.
Right.
It's more a more involved, costly process, but you can absolutely see the difference in clarity.
Oh, absolutely. You can see it. They're very crisp. I could always tell a reissue where they've done a cover scan, and it just has a little bit of a blurry or a dull factor to it. So.
That's right. That's right. And there are times, I'll tell you, where for whatever reason, we have all the session photos, but we cannot find the cover photo. It's happened on occasion. And then we're forced to do the highest quality scan that we can do. So we... Ron has tons of originals. I have tons of originals, and we get the cleanest one we can find, and we'll make a scan of that.
And I imagine the tapes that you get of these sessions, there's the music, but are there also other things on there? Would there be other noises or discussions during the session, or is it just the album the way it was originally mastered?
You know, it depends on the session. There's been some great surprises where you'll hear Alfred and Lee Morgan chatting about, or, you know, what actually happened frequently was Alfred telling, or Rudy rather, telling Art Blakey to not play so loud. And inevitably, you'd hear the next track and Blakey would play louder. that went on for years. That was a classic situation between those two.
Oh, that's amazing. So these are the exact tapes that have Rudy Van Gelder's fingerprints all over them.
Yep. And all the notes are up until I ran into one the other day. We were doing a Lou Donaldson soul jazz record, Mr. Shingling. And that was one where Alfred had left by that point, and Francis Wolfe was supervising. And I noticed, oh, the handwriting on the master is different, because I'm used to seeing Alfred's handwriting for years and years and years. And all of a sudden, it's different. And I'm like, okay, that's Frank Wolfe's handwriting.
Do you ever find extra stuff in the box? Like, I'll give you an example. I talked to Greg Brooks, who manages the Queen archive, and they were talking about they'd open the master tapes, and sometimes they would find notes that are written on the back of Chinese food menus and stuff like that. Do you ever find any sort of strange artifacts from the time that are still in those boxes?
Not so much. What tends to be there is you'll see a record of when the tape had been checked out in the past. And you'll see different mastering notes from, could have been a reissue from the 70s, could have been one from the 80s. And you'll see mastering notes that are left in there that we completely ignore. Mm-hmm. And then interestingly, on many, many tapes, and this kind of gets into a slightly different subject, but when Rudy, you know, originally was recording mono, so 53 to 57, he was recording in mono, and so that's what you have. You have a mono master tape. Mm-hmm. And then about, I used to know this by heart, but it's, and I used to know the exact session, but the in 57, he began to record both stereo and mono. So he would run simultaneous masters. Mm-hmm. He did that for about a year, maybe a year and a half. And then in 50, 8, towards the end, that all stops. And there are literally no more mono masters. There is only a stereo master. And on every tape box, there is the notation, and it didn't change for years. I'll send you some pictures. Every tape box has Alfred's note that says, Mo Master, mono, Mo Master made 50-50 from stereo.
Oh, so everything after 59 or so, every mono is a fold down.
Is a fold down, yep. And there's been, I've seen online arguments, and when we actually started to publish pictures of the masters, that whole thing kind of stopped because people realized, oh, it's right there. It's right there on every tape.
Oh, so that's amazing. So if there's some Lee Morgan album from the early 60s and people are just busting their balls to find a mono version to go along with their stereo version, that's really unnecessary.
You know, you could, for all practical purposes, if you have a mono button on your preamp, you could play the stereo and just hit the mono button and you're going to be there. Now, would Rudy make some different mastering choices when he was summing those together? That could be. But point is that there weren't separate mono masters after around 58, mid 58 on. There are no separate mono masters.
Okay. Now, talking about Rudy Van Gelder, I mean, he's such a hero to those of us who enjoy jazz music. You've been very close to his work. You've had a unique opportunity to really analyze it and inspect it very closely. What technical principles and techniques do you credit for the sound he captured on those records?
Well, you know, of course, Rudy, when he was alive, never liked to talk about that stuff. But I think he was just a genius. When you think of what he was doing and what they were dealing with, you know, the systems of the day, and you know, in the 50s and 60s, the bane of these labels would be returns. And why were records returned? Records would be returned because they'd skip. And you know, Blue Note was selling to, at that time, largely more urban audience, and turntables, you know, would range from everything from kiddie tables to okay, to terrible, to maybe a few people had really good tables, but they had to keep those records sold. And so Rudy, and you hear this when you hear the masters, and we usually would bring in our original copies so we could kind of see. Rudy was very clever. He'd roll the low end and to keep the record from being problematic to play. But he would put a little bump in around 90, 100, 110. He's probably rolling over in his grave right now because he hears, he does not like this kind of talk. But you asked, so so the point is, you get a sense of bass, of low end, without the amount of, without the what's really on that master tape causing a problem for playback. And then you think of playback systems of the 50s and 60s. You know, they were very lossy. The speakers tended to droop on the top end. That was very common. You know, it was a big issue getting, you know, lifelike, as they would say, sound. Mm-hmm. Things were very lossy. So he would typically put a little bump in the upper mid-range to make cymbals and horns be more present. You know, he would boost the presence region a bit. So, and, you know, people will say, well, that's not accurate. You know what? I think it's genius. It made those records play back in a way that was was different, was incredibly exciting, and sounded more like those people playing in your room than many other engineers. So I just, you know, deep bow and hats off to Rudy for what he did.
That's amazing. I'd never considered how he would have to target the records toward the equipment of the day. I mean, it's obvious now, but but it's interesting that with those compromises, with those decisions he made for the 60s audio systems, that they still have such a fantastic sound 60 years later.
No doubt. No doubt. So when Ron and I started Music Matters, we had a choice to make. You know, there's two ways you can go about reissues. One is, and there's no right or wrong, in my opinion. There's, although this is, you know, this is like discussing politics. You know, people get very worked up over this, but you can try to master to replicate the sound of the original vinyl. That's one way to do it. We chose not to do that. We chose, other people have done that. We chose, especially once we sat with master tapes, we were just blown away by how, I mean, literally stunned when we put up that first, the big beat, I'll never forget. I was sitting there with Kevin Gray and Ron, and we realized we'd never heard this record before. There are things here that we never, for all of our copies or originals, we had never heard. And we made a decision to try to go for the sound of the master and try to let that come through unimpeded. And doesn't mean that we wouldn't maybe make a few adjustments here and there. When I say a few, I mean a very few. We never wanted to add any compression because we didn't need to. And occasionally run into a tape that was a little bass shy for some reason, or a tape that was a little bass heavy for some reason, or, you know, but generally we wanted those tapes. We wanted, when you bought the record, that you would be like a fly on the wall in Rudy's studio.
The tape, it sounds like that was the vision of the band and Rudy. And then going from the tape to the master, that was a series of compromises for the market.
Yeah, that's an accurate way to describe it. Again, I think he was incredibly clever, because I'll tell you, a lot of people dealt with that problem at that time. All you have to do is look at rock records during that time, or pop records. You know, the way they did it was simply just eliminate the low end, and they didn't put a bump anywhere. You know, it would just be, and that record would play on anything. You wouldn't have a return. But Rudy knew he wanted to give a sense of what the bass player was doing and to have some sense of foundation to that music. So very clever when you think about it.
In terms of the materials, records themselves, the Blue Note records in their heyday, let's say, pre-65 or so, were all pressed at the Plastilite pressing plant in New Jersey.
Yes, that's correct.
What role did that specific pressing plant play in the Blue Note sound?
It's a good question. I don't know. You know, the reason I'm hedging a little bit is that I have heard, just before you called, I was looking at a record not pressed at Plastilite, but with the Van Gelder stamp. And the record sounds fantastic. Sounds great. I don't know who pressed it. It was during, you know, the United Artists period, but they were still using a stamper from Rudy. And the record sounds great. So I honestly don't know. I haven't done enough, a really careful test of, here's the exact same thing, Plastilite, non-Plastilite, to know for sure. But they're pretty hardy. They're, you know, those Plastilite pressings were pretty durable.
Oh yeah. Oh, they're some of them are like bricks. I mean, they're so thick and heavy. And but I always assume Plastilite was used primarily for convenience. I mean, New Jersey's just, you know, across the river.
That's the case. That's probably, you know, It was probably what was convenient. And whether they were thinking of sonic properties, I don't know.
Now, today with the Tone Poet Blue Note series,
right.
This is a series that kind of sits between where Music Matters was and the, I'll just say, the consumer reissues that have been happening for the past several years at Blue Note. Those are about $20-$25. Music Matters tends to be around $50 plus. Tone Poet is, I believe, right at $35. Correct me if I'm wrong here.
That's correct.
Okay. That's a nice meeting. What were the factors in making that decision to $35? And what do you give up from, say, the Music Matters series, and what do you gain from that the budget ones don't have?
So it's a great question. I'll tell you honestly, I didn't know what they were going to retail for until I saw pre-sale notices. I didn't know. Don told me when we started this, he said, and he'd been very open in many, many interviews. I'd hear him talking about interviews where he was supposed to be talking about his 75th anniversary series of 100. And I'd hear him start right off talking about Music Matters, it was incredibly flattering, but it was kind of shocking too. And he would say things like, you know, these guys, they cracked the code. They cracked the Blue Note code. I don't know how they did it, but they did. And so he told me when he first approached me, which was during actually a Charles Lloyd recording that we were doing together, Vanished Gardens, he said, I want you to come on board and help us. And I want this series to be exactly like you do for Music Matters in every respect. And I said, that's great, because if you want to use my name, it would have to be that way. And Don has been amazing. He's been fantastic. Could not ask for anything more. I mean, mastering, pressing, packaging, all of it. He has not said no to anything. So they are literally, if you take the case of a Blue Note, say, from the 60s, the way I go about it isn't one iota different than what we do for Music Matters, with one exception, which only applies to this series that Music Matters is doing, just started releasing in 2019, where there's it turns out to be a very costly vinyl formulation that they're using the raw cost adder. I mean, cost to the manufacturer is another $8 per LP. I don't mean to the consumer, I mean to the vendor. And so that raises the price of the Music Matters quite a bit. It's a great vinyl formulation. We're not doing that on the Tone Poet series, because it would put the retail up higher than they want to be. So
right. Okay. So Music Matters, especially the new pressings that are happening in the last several months and going forward, they use a compound that is very high quality, almost to the point where it almost prices some people out.
It could be. But yeah, it's raw cost is, when I say it adds another $8, I'm totally serious. That's the cost. Very costly. And you know, we've worked with the other formulation for a dozen years and have got tremendous results. Are they as just jet black, dead quiet as this new one? Not quite, but they're damn good. That's where we are.
We have that discussion frequently in the audio field. People spending hundreds of dollars, even on cables, to just shave off a little bit of noise or little subtle changes. There comes the point of diminishing return, though. But you've made the determination that $8 per record, and in the Music Matters packages, a lot of them are double record sets. So an extra $16 in raw costs gives equal or greater amount of return based on that to the ears. Is that right?
It's, you know, if your system is really top notch all the way, and that includes your turntable, your cartridge, your arm, the whole thing, then there is some advantage there. Is it when it came to the Tone Poet series? I honestly, Nate, I didn't even bring it up because I knew without even asking that that was going to put it over an edge that I just instinctively knew they didn't want to do. And I didn't really think it was absolutely essential anyway.
Sure.
Cool to have. Very costly to get.
Well, the way I think about it is Music Matters is Rolls Royce, Tone Poet is Mercedes, and the consumer grade are a good solid Honda.
I'll go for that. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Now, on Tone Poet, are they all 33 RPM?
Yes.
Okay. Music Matters, you do a smattering 33 and 45. What makes you decide to go for one or the other?
Actually, the way it went down is they were 45s up until about 2 years ago. And at that point, we'd done 140 or something titles, maybe 150. And at that point, we decided to start doing 33. So there was never a point where we did both together. It was 33s, 45s for many years. And then we decided, as we went into some of the little more exploratory titles, that we would just do 33s. And there's a group of people that don't like to get up every 15, 12 minutes. And I see their point. You know, they like to hear the record in the sequence that it was originally. I mean, we never changed sequence with the 45s, but meaning that the side is as you remember it. And so, yeah, we changed at Music Matters to 33s a few years ago. And all of this last series, which is the last series of the label, the last 12, those are all 33s. There's no 45s.
Mm, okay. So are you going to keep Music Matters Jazz going while you do the Tone Poet series?
Well, this last 12 was released all together at one time on January 1st. And so for a year, they'll both be out there at the same time. Well, the Music Matters dozen will be out there as long as people are buying them, that group of 12. But yeah, they will both exist. There is, with Tone Poet, I made a decision to not share any titles that either Music Matters had done, or Acoustic Sounds, or Classic Records in the Blue Note catalog. I wanted to, there's so many great titles that hadn't been done yet that I wanted to do. And then also, it wasn't strictly, you know, the mandate wasn't to only focus on Blue Note, primarily Blue Note, but the Blue Note family of labels, which includes Solid State and Pacific Jazz. When they made it clear I could pick from some of those groups as well, I was like, okay, one of the first titles to come out is actually not a Blue Note record. It's Chick Corea's amazing trio record, one of the first trio records he made, and it was on the Solid State label. Mm-hmm. This is a record featuring Miroslav Fetus and Roy Haynes that pianists hold up as, you know, right there with some of the Bell Evans trios. And yeah, that's on Solid State. That's not on Blue Note.
So the two titles that the Tone Poet series kick off with are that Chick Corea, Now He Sings, Now He Sobs, and Correct. Wayne Shorter, Etc.
Yes.
Why those two titles? I mean, Wayne Shorter, for example, that was released, well, it was recorded in 65, I think, released in 1980, pretty unceremoniously. So it seems like, okay, are we just kind of getting our sea legs right now with these titles?
You know, so two thoughts about that. I wanted one, Tone Poet also takes material or can take material from the modern Blue Note catalog. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted one of the first two to be sort of an indicator that this series was going to be a little different than what people are used to. And I thought, That's a good way to do it. You know, the Chick record, first of all, is not on Blue Note. It's not recorded by Rudy. And it's actually recorded by Don Hahn, who's a great engineer as well. And I thought that would be a good indicator that this was going to be a little broader in scope than just mining that same period. Although we're going to do plenty of that too.
I've seen the release schedule, at least for 2019, two titles a month coming out. And it is very interesting to see the diversity of the titles. In some cases, you go way back into the Blue Note archives. Kenny Burrell, introducing Kenny Burrell. I think that was 56. Yeah. And then I think a month later, you've got Lee Morgan Cornbread from 65. So in those 9 to 10 years, what are the audio changes or the recording changes that you can sense just from listening to those masters?
So it's a great question. You know, there are certain things that come up with Rudy's studio in Hackensack. So the Kenny Burrell title, Introducing Kenny Burrell, that's recorded obviously in Hackensack, and that's a mono title. He always had great microphones. Rudy was a total gearhead. And so, you know, you start with great microphones. He'd always have these great Neumanns and other mics, but you're going to have a good result. And, you know, his reverb, he would add reverb because the sound of the living room at Rudy's house is very dead. So there's a certain kind of sound of Hackensack that you get used to, and you get used to kind of the things that you need to do to sort of help that a bit and enhance it in certain ways. And then when he moves to Englewood Cliffs, that's a different sound. And of course, now you're dealing with stereo. Although he did some stereo recording in Hackensack as well. But it's different room, different sound, and he starts to use different microphones as well. So, each period, you know, early Englewood Cliffs, 1960, 61, that has a certain sound. Later Englewood Cliffs, 64, 65, it changes again. So, yeah, there's an evolution to what he did, for sure.
Can you hear one of the masters and tell exactly where it was recorded?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I've never had a blindfold test, but I mean, at this point, it would be not fair because I'd know the session right away and would know the time. There's a sound. The reverb, for instance, that in the early Hackensack days, you know, he's dealing with spring reverb. And so you can hear, you know, kind of the boingy quality of that. I mean, it's all over, for instance, those Miles Davis records, not on Blue Note, but on Prestige Cooking, yeah. Steaming. You can hear the spring reverb just clear as a bell. And then he starts to use plate reverb and more advanced forms of reverb later on. So, yeah, again, being such a technical adept guy, he changed as new gear became available.
So we talked quite a bit about the vinyl itself, but what about the package? I know you have access to all the pictures and the notes and things like that. When people purchase a Tone Poet record, what can they expect from the sleeve?
You know, where we have access to the photos, and I was looking at the list, you know, most of these, there's many of them. I'd say, you know, 13 or so of the 18, maybe 14. We have access to session photos, and those records will come out as gatefolds with session photos on the inner gatefold. The same as you've seen with Music Matters, we're doing it the same way. Where we don't have photos, I just ran into this with a Lou Donaldson title that was later on. There actually aren't session photos. Then we're not going to create a gatefold for no reason. It'll be a single sleeve, but done in a very, what they call tip-on sleeve, so very high quality. But where we have extras in terms of photos, we'll use them, and they'll be included.
So you'll have all the original notes from Ira Gittler and the like on the back, everything as well?
Yep.
Okay. Music Matters Jazz Is that exclusively Blue Note, or do you also have titles from Prestige? Would you consider doing a similar series? Obviously, it wouldn't be on Tone Poet, but Music Matters, some of the Prestige titles.
You know, we have never done that. It's been exclusively Blue Note, but those Prestige titles have been covered. Of course, there's a ton of them, but Acoustic Sounds has done quite a few of those. Hmm. So those have been reissued. Relatively, I'm just going to say in the last 15 years, they've been reissued.
Okay. I'll go hassle Chad for those.
Okay. He's got them. He's got them.
Cool. Well, look, Joe, I'm very excited about hearing these Tone Poet editions of Wayne Shorter, of course, Chick Corea coming out, but also, you know, Kenny Burrell, Lee Morgan, a bunch of really, really cool titles. And now, there are already a couple of records out there that have had a bit of this treatment, right? The Art Blakey, Africaine, Bobby Hutcherson, Patterns from the Blue Note Review, right?
You're right. That was actually the first project I worked on after we put this thing together. And Don was very serious about upping the game, upping the quality of the records that came in those Blue Note Review boxes. So I treated those exactly like I would treat a Music Matters released. I mean, nothing was different. Those aren't gatefold jackets, but they're tip-on, beautifully done jackets from Stoughton Printing, and sonically done just like we would do anything else. No difference there.
Now, those two recordings also, if the audience doesn't know what we're talking about, this is on the Blue Note Review Volume 2, Spirit and Time, and those are two vinyl titles that are included in the box set. These sessions, Africaine and Patterns, they were recorded decades earlier, apparently shelved, and then given a bit of a release, questionable release, in the late 70s or early 80s.
Correct.
And that's actually a similar trajectory to the Wayne Shorter, et cetera. How much material does Blue Note have like this? What other missing sessions are there out there? Oh, yeah?
So you're going to see in the Tone Poet series, you know, there's Donald Byrd's Chant, which is a great, just an amazing session. There's a number. I got to get my list here. Hank Mobley session. There's, let me look through here. I pulled out all the records. Yeah, there's Chant. Grant Green, Born to Be Blue. There's one where we'll come up with a new cover. There's a bunch of them.
Wow.
Oh, there's a Gil Evans. That was exciting to do this. Gil Evans, New Bottle, Old Wine. Interesting story there. I always loved the record because it was like, with that, instead of Miles as the lead instrument, it was Cannonball Adderley just at his peak. I mean, just brilliant. But the Sonics had always been a little dubious on every edition that I ever had. And it's a long story, but we found the master. You know, they hadn't had it. It had been mismarked and put in the wrong place. But we got the master, and we put it up at Kevin's, and we both looked at each other like, "Holy crap! Listen to that!" And so, we've had test pressings. Don's heard it. Jem has heard it. And they both called and said, "What the hell? What is that? Sounds amazing." So there's those where it's really exciting to be able to put out something. People are going to hear the record in a way they've never heard it before.
It's tempting to think about some of these recordings, these sessions that were recorded but then never released. It's tempting to think about them as second best. They're the offcuts. They weren't released for some sort of reason.
You know, there are cases where that you can actually trace back. Lee Morgan, this comes up sometimes. Once he had that hit with Sidewinder, there were great sessions that got shelved just because they wanted him to make another Sidewinder. But there's records like the one I was looking for, I couldn't think of, is Dexter Gordon Clubhouse. Amazing session. It's a great session. Why didn't it get released? You know, I can only think that they were doing so much. There was only really two guys and an office person. I don't know that they would remember or even know why they didn't put it out. They were recording so much at that time.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are some ones that didn't come out that should never come out because they stink. Yeah, really. And Michael would say the same thing. There are a few that there's very good reasons why they didn't get released.
Yeah, those are the ones that I think of immediately. But yeah, I imagine just in Blue Note in their heyday, there's so much stuff happening. These guys are creating so much material that, yeah, there's only so many hours a day and some stuff is just going to get shelved. Who knows why, but I'm very glad it still exists. Now, do you have to bake the tapes at all? Are they all in great shape? Anything you have to do?
So that's a good question. You know, what's funny is the older tapes are actually incredibly tough and hardy. So Scotch 111 is most of the Rudy tapes from the 50s up till about 63 or 4 is on Scotch 111. And that stuff, Nate, sounds like it was recorded yesterday.
Hmm.
I mean, it literally sounds like it was recorded yesterday. It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
As you get into the more modern formulations, they become a little bit more fragile, and that's where you sometimes have to bake them.
We recently had John McDermott, who is the archivist for the Jimi Hendrix estate, and he shared with me, and again, you can confirm or refute, but he said around 1972, tapes made after 72 tend to need baking because that's when they stopped using whale oil in the compound.
Right. So yeah, the Scotch 111, God only knows what's in that. I'm sure it's
orphans.
We don't want to know. Yeah, we don't want to know. But yeah, it's people ask that, you know, maybe the old ones sound better because, you know, the tapes are aged. Not Scotch 111. That stuff, you put it up, it sounds like they recorded it yesterday.
This is really great information. And Joe, I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for hanging out with us here on The Vinyl Guide. I do want to encourage the audience to check out the Tone Poet series over at store.bluenote.com. The two titles that are coming out immediately, I believe, Wayne Shorter, etc., and Chick Corea, Now He Sings, Now He Sobs. But there's a whole series lined up for the rest of the year. You can Google the press release, and there's a lot of great stuff coming out. Again, go to store.bluenote.com or go to acousticsounds.com. Don't go to Amazon. They make enough money selling laundry detergent. Also, Music Matters Jazz. A lot of phenomenal titles up there. That is Joe's previous gig, but a lot of great work has gone into those titles, and pick those up. I've got a couple of Music Matters vinyl discs, and it sounds like you're in the room inside the session, just like Joe says, a fly on the wall. So again, it's brilliant work you've done, Joe, and thanks again for doing all that great stuff. Hope to have you back on the show and keep making all that great stuff that we love.
That's the plan. Thank you so much, Nate. It was a pleasure.
Alrighty, thank you, Joe, for coming on the show. I love that discussion. I could talk to that man for hours, and I've seen his record collection, just an image of it, and it's just it's amazing. / I'm a little concerned for him that he may be a hoarder, but man, this guy knows his stuff. Again, Joe Harley, the Tone Poet. You could check out the new Blue Note Tone Poet series over at bluenote.com. Joe's also written a little bit of a dissertation on Blue Note tone poetry and autophilia. There's a link up there where you could hear it from the man himself.
And of course, check out musicmattersjazz.com. A lot of great reissues up there of some of the most amazing jazz albums ever recorded. And one last plug, I've done an unboxing video of the brand new Blue Note Review, the box set that they have, Spirit and Time. Just Google Vinyl Guide Blue Note, and I'm sure it'll come up in the video feed. All right, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in. I think I may be back next week, but I may take a week off. Who knows? Lots of personal stuff happening. But look, in the meantime, make sure to check out patreon.com/vinylguide. Support us if you can. Go to our sponsor, Groove Washer, groovewasher.com. Great record cleaning kits, and you can get 10% off with promo code VINYLGUIDE10. And other than that, we've got 150-something other episodes at thevinylguide.com. Please enjoy, and until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.